Okay, Shalom Aleichem, good morning. Thank you everyone for coming out. I'm a bit biased, but I give everyone credit for choosing to come to Rabbi Fink. Rabbi Fink, just to give a bit of his background, grew up originally in Teaneck, New Jersey. We actually went to MTA together, as well as Karen B'Yavne, and then came here to learn in yeshiva here. And Rabbi Fink already finished his smicha, as well as receiving a master's in social work in Wurzweiler right here. Rabbi Fink last year was the rabbinic intern in Young Israel of West Hempstead, and this year is the intern at Young Israel of Passaic Clifton under the close watch, close guidance of Rabbi Yaakov Glasser Shlita. Rabbi Fink goes without saying, one of the jewels of the Beis Medrash, a pillar of Talmud Torah of leadership, but specifically, Rabbi Fink also is unique in his insights in medical ethics, medical halacha, Jewish history, as well as a bevy of topics that Rabbi Fink is uniquely qualified to speak about amongst the Chavrei HaKollel. So I give the floor to Rabbi Fink. Thank you very much.
Kanetsky, thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here, a pleasure to be a part of this conference, and more so what the conference represents. And certainly that's the ability to continue, primarily, as was mentioned this morning, primarily immersed in years of Talmud Torah here in the Beis Medrash, but an additional elements that one gains from being part of this environment is having access to certainly Talmidei Chachamim, Bereshis Rav Sokolovsky, who I've certainly gained so much from, Rav Sokolovsky and all the other Rebbeim that are here in the yeshiva, who have made such an incredible impact on me in so many ways, and having them as resources to reach out to on a variety of topics is certainly something that's a very, very unique and a special opportunity. In addition to that, having the resources and abilities to research a topic and really delve fully into it, especially, you know, courtesy of the fifth floor of the library and the librarians who are there that help you find a lot of fun things, some of which we will discuss today. Today's topic is historical dissection, halacha's integration of medical sciences through the ages. We'll get to at least one of these pictures in a little bit more detail as we continue with the presentation. So let's jump right in. Let's see where people are holding. What areas of halacha are impacted by medicine? So just call it out. Call it out. What we think? Taras Mishpacha. Good. What else?
Shabbos.
Good. What else?
End of life.
Okay. And I would like to acknowledge also we have an expert in the room on medical halacha. So when I say anything wrong, just yell at me. That's fine. And that's the story. So this is just a random list of areas of halacha that are impacted by medicine. This is probably made at like 1 in the morning when I was tired and just put a bunch of things on the list. And some of them we mentioned. You know, Shabbos was mentioned. Taras HaMishpacha was mentioned. Fertility, end of life, as we mentioned, was mentioned this morning. Rabbi Shabtai has written extensively about the topic. Conjoined twins, organ donation. Again, a lot of various topics, emphasis on the et cetera, because there are definitely a wide range of areas impacted by medicine and halacha. The ones that we're going to focus on today is fasting on Yom Kippur, fertility issues, and mitzitza bepeth. That's going to be the focus for today, just to narrow within this topic at least somewhat. And the goal of the presentation certainly will not be to give an extensive overview of all of these very vast topics, but at least to give a little bit of an insight, or at least to scratch on the surface of these topics, and hopefully also to be ma'or aleif ha'ma'ayinim bo, to instill and excite some people who might want to investigate further. As I mentioned, the slides will be available after on Y Torah, Mir Hashem. So for anyone that's interested, at least to give a framework of at least a beginning of a way to think about some of these topics and the impact that medical halacha, and in particular, we're going to talk a lot about medical history, have an impact on practical halacha. So to address any of these topics, one really has to be a posek, and we have a posek in the room. We also have a few medical doctors in the room, neither of which is the one that is currently presenting. So if that's true, so you might have some of the sentiments that are expressed in the comic up on board. And if that's true, that's okay. But as I mentioned, this will just be a little bit of an overview of some of the excitement that I've developed as I've been looking into this topic, some of the resources I've come across. And through them, again, hopefully will be at least something to excite people, something to a way of thinking of things, and a way to look into these topics with more rigor and with more of a thorough approach. So again, as we mentioned, reproductive medicine will be the first topic. Then we'll talk a little bit about fasting on Yom Kippur and mitzitza bepeth. So those are the upcoming topics. So let us begin with the halachic history of the reproductive sciences. So that begins exactly a week ago from yesterday. We learned Parshas Tezria, which talks about childbirth. And the pasuk says, "Dabrei ben Yisrael, speak to the Jewish people, le'marisha ki Tezria." That when a woman conceives, v'yalda zachar, which we'll translate that for now, isha ki Tezria, when a woman conceives, v'yalda zachar, and she gives birth to a boy, v'tama shevas yamim, and then discusses the fact that this generates some form of ritual impurity. Now the Gemara, here in Nida Daf Chaf Hei Mabiz, which a lot of the Chavra is learning this year, learn something very interesting from this line. Isha mezras tchila yoledes zachar. That Rav Yitzchak Bar Ami says that if a woman is mezras tchila, conceives first, yoledes zachar, the vlad, the offspring, will be a boy. Ish mezriat tchila, but if a man is mezriat first, if he conceives first, yoledes nekeva. So he... So then the child will produce a girl. Now, based on contemporary medicine, and for those who recently learned Hilchos Nidah or Chasam classes, perhaps some of this will be more familiar. Otherwise, we'll have to rely on our ninth grade biology for a lot of this topic. But doesn't seem to resonate with anything that we're familiar with, the fact that the outcome of the gender of a child relates to anything that is being discussed in this Maamar Chazal. The Gemara even says, and perhaps a more well-known Gemara, talks about how there are three partners. Shlosha shotfim yesh ba'adam, that there are three partners that create a child, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, v'aviv v'imo, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, the father and the mother. And the Gemara actually continues to discuss and describes specific material that the father contributes, specific material that the mother contributes. And again, based on contemporary medical sciences, we'll have to figure out if any of these elements resonates with our contemporary understanding and also the historical development of the medicine that relates to fertility, conception, embryology, etc. So that is an upcoming topic. So let's begin back with medicine and philosophy for a little bit of the background. So this over here is a artistic portrayal of Aristotle and Galen. Okay, these are both were philosophers as well as physicians. Back in those times, the fields of medicine and philosophy were not well defined, and they did not necessarily have their own set of studies and areas. So basically, people who were smart did both. So Aristotle was a pretty smart guy, so he was a philosopher and also was somewhat of a physician, and suggested a number of theories, which we'll review briefly, as to medicine in general, specifically with regards to our topic of what the concept of conception. And Galen as well, similarly, was a philosopher. His legacy is actually a lot more in medicine more than philosophy, but he also was deeply involved in both. In terms of the history of anatomy, how did we come to understand the workings of the human body in general? So over here, like I mentioned, there's the picture that was on the front page. This is, here we go, Rembrandt's painting of the anatomy lesson of Professor Nicholas Tulp in 1632. So that is a very fascinating picture for a number of reasons, because in 1632, just a couple years earlier to that, was the first time that human bodies were used, human cadavers were used to actually dissect the human body, and were used as a method of medical research and for medical instruction as well for medical students. The first time in history was a little bit before 1632. That's when the painting was made. But one of the fascinating things about this, which goes together with the anatomical theater in Padua and Andrea Vesalius, who was the first medical practitioner and instructor to use human cadavers to instruct anatomy and to do research and also to train future medical students. So the way it was done, and this is noteworthy for both of these pictures, the Anatomical Theater of Padua is one of the oldest and I believe one of the few remaining anatomical theaters. What is an anatomical theater? So if you look over here in the painting, you see that is, I believe, supposed to be the doctor, the instructor. The rest of these people are a combination. They all actually are identified. We know who they are. They were a number of different, a combination of prominent doctors and politicians and public figureheads who came to be a part of this dissection and came to learn. This was something that was, considered to be from the higher class of society, and not just entertainment, but of higher scholarship and learning. And people would come, actually, to these anatomical theaters, which were the ways that people learned about anatomy. People did not, the only one that actually did anything hands-on with the human cadaver was the medical instructor or the researcher, in this case over here in this painting, it would be Dr. Tulp. But the students did not have any hands-on involvement. They would merely be observing. And this was also a sign of stature, a sign of position, a sign of certain academic prowess and so on, to be a part of these dissections, of these presentations. So it wasn't just doctors. This painting, actually, every individual in the painting, besides for the doctor, paid a commission to be a part of it, because this was basically significant free advertising that they received. And it wasn't free. They had to pay for it. Because if you were in this painting, it showed that you were on the cutting edge of society. You were on the cutting edge of the medical sciences. And you were part of, the most recent up-to-date medical research. So that's the first time in terms of the history of anatomy, and that's the first time we're actually looking into a human body to try to figure out what's actually going on. So the theories that are there prior to could actually, perhaps sometimes lead to mistakes. One of them is represented here up there on the board. But in any case, so let's talk specifically about the history of embryology for human reproduction. So we mentioned Galen. We mentioned Aristotle. So Galen, together with Hippocrates, another, again, philosopher and a medical doctor of the time, basically suggested that there is both male and female seed it plays a role in human conception. Aristotle disagreed, and he said that there is only male seed, and the woman does not have seed. William Harvey, going a bunch of years later, many, many years later, 1578, through 1657, suggested that all living things come from eggs, which is more or less true. Reinhard de Graaf in 1672 was the first one to describe the egg follicle, and Carl Ernst von Baer in 1827 publishes his description of the mammalian ovum, and those are artistic portrayals of some of those characters. So now we go to that's a lot of scientific and medical background and history. Let's jump into some Torah, and let's jump to the Ramban on that pasuk. The Ramban discusses the fact, this Maimar Chazal, which we begin with, which got us thinking. Isha mazras tchila isha ki zazria. The pasuk says that when a woman conceives, isha mazras tchila yoledas zachar, that if a woman conceives first, so she will have a boy. So says the Ramban, ve'ein kavanasam shiyasa havlad mizara isha. Their intention is not that the child is produced from the seed of the Isha, Kia Isha, Alpha Hishiesh La Baitsum Kibesa Zachar, even though anatomically the Ramban is assuming, as similar to what we know today, is that there is a source where the woman produces something, but he says, O Shalo Yasa Bahan Zara Klal, perhaps there's no seed that's produced from them, O Sheena Zarahu Nikba Velo Osa Davar Ba'ubar, or that element does not actually produce anything or contribute to the development of the embryo, of the fetus, of Amram, Mazras al Dama Rechem, it refers to the blood, that something happens at the time that the husband and wife are together. Kiludaitam Havlad notes are midamana keva mi lubana ish. According to their opinion, the Vlad, according to the opinion of Chazal, the Vlad is produced from the blood from the woman, umi lubana ish, and from the way that comes from the man, and then when you combine the two of them, so that is what actually is being referred to as the zera. And then the Ramban continues a little bit, and also says, "V'gam das harof in beitzira kachi." The Ramban says that if you go to contemporary medical sciences, that's what the doctors of the time say as well. And the Ramban then actually continues to refer to philosophers. In this case, he's referring to the opinion of Aristotle's opinion on conception, that kol guf ha'uber midama isha, that the entire body comes from the woman. Ein bali ish ala koach hayadua b'lashonam hiyuli. That hiyuli, for those who are bold in Greek philosophy is very big on this hiyuli, some form of life force, whatever it is exactly. So that's the assumption that the Ramban then brings in to refer to some other way of approaching the matter of the conception. Now we go to a few other models. We'll go through these a little bit quicker, but Ibn Ezra has what I like to call the Mother Earth model, and basically describes the fact of Hine Perish Tazria Titein Zara Kihi Kamo Haaretz. That Mother Earth, right, that phrase is very much built on this model of conception, is the fact that the same way a person puts a seed into the ground and the ground develops it, and produces the plants, produces the crop, so too the woman is like the earth and is the one that fosters the growth of the seed. Rabbi Bachaya has a very similar idea. He says, actually very interesting, Perusha Timsor Hazera, he's referring again to this line, Isha Ki Sazria, he says, Ki Hu Pikadon Etzla, Minazachar. He actually, like a collateral, that a person gives someone over, an item over to someone else to watch, expecting it eventually to be returned. Rabbi Bachaya assumes that is similar to what is happening when conception happens. The Rambam, we're not going to go into the Rambam's idea, but the Rambam in quite a decent amount of detail, pretty close to what we assume today as well, describes the female anatomy and how the production actually happens. Doesn't go into exact detail on who is contributing what, but certainly something to think about. The Sforno, a couple years later, has, again, starting to develop a little bit of a take on it. We're not going to read it inside, but it's here for anyone that wants to take a look at it. The Tartamima, more recently, from 1860 to 1941, of Barclay B. Epstein, he describes something that's also actually reminiscent of certain philosophical concepts, the Mishum Da'akol Holich Achar HaKoach HaAchron, that everything follows from the Koach HaAchron. So whatever was the last thing to contribute towards some action, so that's going to be the one that leaves the strongest impact. So that's the way he understands that if the Isha's Mezras Tchila, so if she's the one that contributes something first, the one that contributes something second will be the Ish. So then the Ish, the Koach HaZachar, the male power, will be the one that is more influential. Fine. Tobias Cohn is not someone usually quoted in a Beis Medrash, but he was a pretty big Talmid Chacham. We mentioned earlier the University of Padua, which has become one of my more recent obsessions, not just because the Ramchal spent his primary years in Padua, and the Chevra of Talmidim that he learned together with. The Ramchal was fascinating for a million reasons, but at least one of the reasons he was fascinating, his Chevra was university students at the University of Padua. Tobias Cohn, I think, may or may not have had, yeah, I think we do know that they had what to do with each other, to check that. We actually have beautiful poetry and art that is attributed to the Ramchal, that the Ramchal wrote in honor of Jewish students graduating from the University of Padua and receiving a medical diploma. So today, medical diplomas are pretty boring. In those days, there was a lot of artwork and poetry and beautiful things that was put on the their diploma, and Ramchal wrote some of the poetry, incredibly beautiful. If you want more, if that for some reason interests you, but Rabbi Dr. Artie Reichman, who a lot of this research comes from, his recent book, The Anatomy of Jewish Law, which we will quote from directly, hopefully later in the presentation. So he actually has a few articles on this and a few presentations he's given about the history of the Jewish relationship with the University of Padua. One of the people who he likes a lot is this guy, Tobias Cohn. Tobias Cohn was a doctor, he received his degree from the University of Padua, and he comes out with a sefer called Maisa Tovia. Hebrew name was Tovia. And what he tries to do is go through the contemporary medical sciences of the time and attempts to make them shtim, more or less, you know, align with what Chazal tell us and what Chazal had in mind. Mirza Hashem, towards the end of the presentation, we'll talk, I hope, to talk about why that doesn't inspire me a ton, and why I have some other views on Chazal and medicine, and more broadly, Chazal and science. In any case, over here, he goes through a pretty advanced description of what we know about the way that conception happens. Again, pretty advanced for that time, 1652 through 1729. Again, he's in the university that is more or less on the avant-garde of the scientific and medical progress. So he has it pretty close. He's quoting from William Harvey, who we referred to earlier, who is, again, referring to the concept of the fact that the female is contributing eggs towards the conception. As well, over here, he argues pretty strongly on Aristotle and has pretty fun language about how Aristotle was a kofer and denied Torah and likes to makes a big deal about that. In any case, he also refers to the fact that there have been elements of reproduction that have been observed under a microscope, which was a pretty recent invention of the time. So before that, people were looking at something, things that were happening just with their natural vision. But for the first time in history, relatively recently, I'm pretty sure he had smicha. At least he was Yodei Sefer. He knew how to learn. His father was a rabbi. His grandfather was a rabbi as well. So he at least knew how to learn, and came up with a Sefer. Sefer Ma'aseh Tovah. He has fascinating diagrams. In them, some of them look very similar, actually, to the ones that you'll find in a ninth grade biology textbook. But they're very fascinating historical tidbit. Dr. Landrum B. Shettles lives from 1909 to 2003. He is an embryologist and is a fertility doctor, OBGYN, and so on, basically that whole category of reproductive medicine. And in 1960, I gave you the reference of the first article of a series of articles that he publishes on the research in this department. And in, I believe this book comes out in 1970, where he suggests a fascinating scientific discovery that he found, which has basically not actually been accepted by the scientific and medical community. But it is quoted, like I mentioned, I mentioned the book. It's us, all the Rabbim that are here. So this is quoted pretty extensively, and his theory from Dr. Shettles is described pretty elaborately in Rabbi Dr. Adi Reichman's book. And we'll read like this. He discovers, Dr. B. Shettles observed that the Y chromosome travels faster than the X chromosome. So that if a woman ovulates prior to relations, there is a greater likelihood that the Y chromosome will reach the egg first, resulting in a male child. This observation led to the reinterpretation of the Talmudic passage. The word mezeras could refer to ovulation, the emission of the female seed, analogous to the emission of the male seed. Thus, if a woman emits seed first, she will beget a male child. This reinterpretation of the rabbinic passage was known even to Shettles himself and is found repeatedly in works of Jewish medical ethics. So certainly an absolutely fascinating suggestion of how to align what was known to Arayet HaChazal, based on this pasuk that we began with in this section of the presentation, of Isha Mezras Tchila, that if the woman makes some contribution towards the conception first, Yoledes Zachar, and based on the fact that he observed that the Y chromosome seems to be traveling faster, so if the ovulation occurred prior, so then that will, statistically, the chances of there being a male child are higher than there being a female child. A pretty wild suggestion. Again, it has not been accepted or adopted by the broader medical scientific community. It has been challenged. His findings have not been able to be replicated in other studies. But it's just at least a fascinating way to at least think about it as a way of, seeing contemporary sciences stemming, aligning with that which Chazal told us thousands of years ago. As I mentioned, this is exciting. It's interesting. In Mirz Hashem, towards the end of the presentation, I will describe why I don't think that's the most exciting element of viewing Chazal and medicine, and more broadly, Chazal and science. So we'll get to that later. Topic number two is fasting on Yom Kippur. So fasting on Yom Kippur, pretty clearly the Shulchan Aruch says that if someone is sick, Chol HaShetzarech Lechol, someone who's sick that needs to eat him, Yesham Rofi Baki, Afilu Hobi Kochavim, Shaomer, and Lo Yochlu, and Lo Yachilo Oso, Afshar Shiachbad al Vacholi Bestakin, Machilin Oso, Al Piv, the Ansar Chlomer Shema Yamos. So if a doctor says that someone has to eat on Yom Kippur, we listen to the doctor, even if they aren't Jewish, and even if the sickness will get more severe, we listen to the doctors, and so on. The Mishnah Berurah over here says that if someone wants to be Machmir on themselves, and the doctors tell them that they must eat on Yom Kippur, they're not allowed to fast, they are not allowed to be machmir on themselves. Olav Namar Ach Dimchem L'Nafsho Seichem Edrosh, very strong terminology, that someone who ignores the advice of medical opinion in this matter. So it says that their blood is essentially on their hands, in very strong terms. What about someone who is expecting, related to the topic before, someone who is expecting or someone who is nursing, do they have to fast as well? Says the Shulchan Aruch, they do. Mis'anos U'mashlimos B'yom HaKippurim, that they must fast and they have to complete their fast on Yom Kippur. Of course, that is with the caveat of if there is a medical concern, so then they are not allowed to fast. And that is an area where, as we mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, to really address these topics properly, one has to be, both a posek, and one also has to be a medical doctor. which I mentioned, neither of them are me, but both of them are currently in this room. So not necessarily the same person, but those two people have to discuss with each other what the appropriate approach would be to areas where there is a concern of someone fasting on Yom Kippur. Rav Yisrael Yaakov Fisher came out with a fascinating psak. He came out, he lives from 1928 to 2003. He lives in the old Yishuv in Yerushalayim, in Jerusalem. And there's a sefer published, the Pnei Baruch on Bikur Cholam Kehilchasov. So it goes through a lot of the halachos of visiting the sick. And he writes, Mashakasov Shama Sitri, Gimel Deisha Shei Pila Kvar Pamim, Mach Masatani Sechol Lahakel Bachilas, Pachos Mikasher Biyom HaKippurim. So he mentions that a woman who has had miscarriages, so she should be more lenient in terms of fasting on Yom Kippur, etc. But says Rav Yisrael Yaakov Fisher, so again, this is printed in the Sefer, and Rav Yisrael Yaakov Fisher, it's actually interesting, he writes a Haskama, and then he says, I'm going to write a Haskama, it's a pretty good Sefer, but I disagree with a bunch of things that you mentioned. So here, find an attached letter where I list off, 32 things that I disagree with you about. Not exactly 32, but a decent amount of things I disagree with you about. And please print them. I give you the Haskama on condition, basically, that you print them at the beginning of the Sefer. This was one of them. He says, Kiyom azah shenechlushu adoros, that today, where people have become weaker, v'asros rebos shel nashem apilos ayadat hanes, and there's so many women, thousands of women, he claims, that are miscarrying as a result of fasting. Tzrichin kalanashim hamubaros adachodesh atshi lechol b'yom kippur and pachos mikashir. He says that on Yom Kippur, all women who are expecting have to eat less than the shear. Which certainly will clarify, eating less than the shear is an iser d'oraisa on Yom Kippur for someone who is healthy. So that's pretty serious. He's basically taking a very strong and universal stance on the halachos of fasting on Yom Kippur, and basically says that based on what he's observed, this is dangerous, we have to be very careful about this, and pretty much all women, almost without exception, who are expecting, have to eat less than a shear on Yom Kippur, and that's what he writes in one of his arguments on the Pnei Baruch, that's printed at the beginning of the Sefer. Rav Neuberger's response, not only Rav Neuberger, but I heard this originally in a shear from him, confirmed a few weeks ago in a conversation. Rav Neuberger's response was that a number of points. Number one is that the medical data that Rav Fisher was basing himself off of was more or less non-existent. I mean, he more or less made an observation of the women that he saw in his community, which, as we mentioned, was the old Yishuv in Yerushalayim, mostly towards the beginning of the 20th century. And for those who are familiar with the history of the old Yishuv, so the environment there was not so great in terms of medical care, in terms of resources, in terms of health, sanitation. There was not so much there in terms of infrastructure, certainly until relatively recently, that there was almost anything there. So Rav Neuberger more or less points out that it's very likely that a lot of the women that Rav Fisher noticed had medical complications as a result of fasting on Yom Kippur were women who did not have that great resources going into Yom Kippur, who did not necessarily, if they were to ask a shayla to a posik or to a doctor prior to Yom Kippur, the psak would have been, you cannot fast. Especially, primarily, one of the major concerns of fasting on Yom Kippur, especially for pregnant women, the doctors in the room will confirm or deny, is dehydration, that a woman who is not adequately hydrated prior to Yom Kippur, that is really one of the primary concerns. Being able to recognize and identify the signs and symptoms of dehydration is certainly a very, very crucial, important thing for rabbanim and doctors to educate their patients and their balabatim about prior to Yom Kippur, because that could really be sakaras nefashos. It could be life-threatening to experience dehydration. So that's certainly a very significant point. So Rav Fisher was noticing what was happening after Yom Kippur, and he noted that this seems to be dangerous. Rav Neuberger responded that his sample size did not seem to be so accurate, and this is reflected as well. There was a presentation that happened, I believe, probably across the hall or in one of the rooms over here, This is Rabbi Dr. Yosef Cohen. He's just a few years older than me. You know, sat over here in the same base medrash just a few years ago. He is also a medical student, does a lot of work in medical research. And he gave a presentation to the Smicha students here, what every rabbi should know about medical research. And he was very kind to allow me to plagiarize directly his presentation and goes through a number of important points with regards to knowing how and what to ask a doctor when it comes to risks, when it comes to fasting on Yom Kippur and some things like that. One of the important points is be wary of physicians that speak in absolutes. So he says, useful to ask the physician if they are ever comfortable with when fasting. The postman in the room will confirm. Apparently it was about 20 years ago that doctors started to tell basically all their patients do not fast. Now when you think about it from the medical perspective, there is, we'll say it like this, no doctor to my knowledge has ever been sued for telling a woman to fast on, to not fast on Yom Kippur. Mm. Meaning that's a pretty safe approach. A pretty safe approach from, you know, in terms of basically any concern is you tell someone to eat. It's not, you know, normally a healthy thing to fast. So there's no motivation, for the most part, from the medical community to tell women to go ahead and fast. So around 20 years ago, the medical community became more cognizant of that. And, you know, if you ask the doctor, are you ever comfortable with women fasting? They say, absolutely not. So that already tells you that something is off. There was medical research done at a Shaarei Tzedek hospital in Yerushalayim. I forget the exact year that this medical research was done. The motivation of the research is interesting. It was from a woman a Muslim woman that wanted to do research on the effects of Ramadan on expecting women. And that was the motivation of the research. And then, of course, Shaarei Tzedek Hospital realized that we have some interest in that as well. So we did some amount of research on that. And they discovered that there's no, for the most part, there's no medical risk primarily to the pregnancy, with the exception, as we mentioned, of any, if there are, of course, any underlying issues or concern about the woman's medical history in general, any reason to be concerned about the particular pregnancy, or anything that, you know, is specific to this case that raises a flag for the doctor, for the most part, and dehydration, with those exceptions, probably a few others, but for the most part, with those exceptions, there is usually not so much reason for concern when it comes to fasting on Yom Kippur. But one has to know how to ask. You know, the postgame have to know how to interact with the doctors, and patients as well have to know how to interact properly with the medical opinion in terms of how to come to a proper conclusion. So that is the second area that we are discussing today, fasting on Yom Kippur, how to approach that topic, and being aware, highlighting a different point. You know, the first point that we mentioned in terms of, you know, Chazal's conception of conception highlights at least one element of the way the medicine has progressed, the way the medical research and science has progressed. The second point is, you know, a lot more, also a little bit more contemporary history, but a lot of how the medicine and halacha sort of view each other and the appropriate way to approach that, both from an area of psak and an area of medicine as well. Mm-hmm. Topic number three, everyone's favorite, mitzitza bepeh. Okay, mitzitza bepeh is a practice described over here in the Mishnah on Shabbos, the Kuf Lama Gimel Amud Aleph, that the Gemara says that on Shabbos we do everything that's necessary for Mila, including Molin, the Mila, Porin, pulling back the membrane, and Mimotzitzin. And you do mitzitza, which means to suction the wounds, v'noson alon espalnes, the kimon, you put other bandages and such on the wound. Rashi says, as Adam, you draw the blood. Even though that makes the chabur, that makes the wound, which is normally forbidden on Shabbos, he says you're allowed to do that because the dam does not come out from its location without suctioning from it. The Gemara there on Amabez mentions that if a moel does not do mitzitza, he does not suction the wound after a bris mila, sakanahu ve'avrinomle, it is dangerous to the child, ve'avrinomle, you remove them from their position. The Gemara says it's not obvious, and the Gemara describes what the chiddush in that might be. The Rambam, similarly, when he brings this down to the halacha, talks about its importance and the fact that there's a sakana without it. He adds in the line, actually, yatsa hadam makamus rechokim, that you have to actually have enough force in the oral suctioning to remove blood from faraway locations. Mitzitza bepeh controversy, rabbinic polemics and applying the lessons of history, is just one example of a series of articles that came out a number of years ago. This was in 2006. And the article reads as follows. Some time ago, a series of babies became infected with serious life-threatening sores in the Rigorna area shortly after they were circumcised. It was alleged, both by physicians and by some local rabbanim, that the sores were the result of the mall performing mitzitza v'peh, the ancient tradition of orally suctioning the wound after incision. The mall, it was alleged, may have had communicable disease and passed it on to the children, who, because of their undeveloped immune systems, were more susceptible to the severe effects of this disease. As a result, some doctors condemned the practice of mitzitza v'peh and sought government involvement to ban or at least regulate the practice. Some rabbis in the community reacted by defending the practice and argued that A, this was a religious rite and therefore not within the purview of the medical community. B, that there was no conclusive proof that the children had been infected by their moel. And C, under no circumstances could a religious Jew deviate from this age-old tradition of mitzitza v'peh. All of these details may sound familiar because they appeared in one form or another recently in our media. But the above is not a depiction of recent events. All this occurred in the 1830s. So this is not a new question, and let's see the way that, again, this is a more recent article in 2006. This is from the NIH. And again, a little bit of provocative and jarring language used as the title, Ultra-Orthodox Jews Criticized Over Circumcision Practice. This is published by the National Institute of Health, 2006. But as you mentioned, this debate began already back in the 1830s. So this is the Tefes Yisrael, Yerav Yisrael Lipschitz, lives in Germany from 1782 to 1860. This is his commentary on Mishnayos. And on the Mishnah, he describes the fact that doctors have raised this concern that there have been cases of babies who, in the aftermath of their bris, had developed some rash, some illness that, unfortunately, in some cases even led to were fatal incidences. And he says, perhaps we should listen to the doctor. Sometimes even we say, Nishtanu Ateva, even though Chazal say that this is something that if you don't do it, it's dangerous. Maybe today it's dangerous to do it. And perhaps sometimes we say that the nature of things have changed. And usually do listen to doctors. He says, nevertheless, Vafel became nearly Livli Lazos Medivre Chazal. He says, nevertheless, we cannot move from that which our Chazal have told us. And even though there is this concern, we must continue to be involved in mitzitza b'peh as a result of the milah, nearly shlo. But he backs off a little bit. He says shlo yimsos kol kach b'chozak mo b'shabbos. Maybe on Shabbos don't do it with as much force as we used to do. But again, he's addressing the issue, and his conclusion is that even though doctors have raised such a concern, we are not going to forego on this. Similarly, the Avnei Nezer, Rav Avraham Bornstein, who is the son-in-law of the Kotzker Rebbe, he's a Hasidic Shiite as well himself, but is also certainly a force to be reckoned with in the halachic realm. His tshuvas are incredibly important. Also wrote the Eglei Tal on Hilchos Shabbos. And he raises the same issue, that maybe mitzitza v'peh is only done, maybe it's not part of the meal itself, maybe it's only there to remove danger, and if the doctor says it's a danger, we're not going to read from inside. But he makes a very similar argument, primarily that even though doctors have been raising this concern, this is our ancient, age-old practice that we do, and we must continue to do it. He actually argues, he says that what Chazal tell us, and this is a very important point, what Chazal tell us that this is to remove danger, they don't only tell us that this is to remove physical danger, but perhaps there's some spiritual element that we're not able to put our finger on in a medical or scientific way, but is a very important thing for us to continue to do, that there might be some spiritual element that the mitzitza v'peh accomplishes, and therefore we must continue to do it. Rav Yaakov Ellinger, more of a Yeki from Germany, and he writes Tshuvas Ben Yitzion, and he also is, at that time, is contending very strongly, together with Rav Yaakov Ellinger, followed by his Talmud Rav Hirsch, are very much fighting against the Reform movement and development in Germany and, in the world of that time. And he was similarly, addresses this point and this question and comes down very strongly with similar arguments in the sense that we cannot move or hide away from that which Chazal told us to do. Even if doctors are mentioning this, doesn't make a difference. We continue with doing mitzitza v'peh. Again, it's on the slides for those who want to look at this with more detail. 2005, as a result of a somewhat famous or infamous case that happened in the New York area with the moel connected to circumcision, the New York City Department of Health writes a very strong and particularly severe, I think, worded letter to the community. And basically, you know, just to highlight one or two lines, let's see which line we want to... But basically they say the Mitzitza Bapaz has undoubtedly been linked to infection that has resulted in children as a result of their bris, and therefore we have to be very careful about it, and we recommend and we advise against doing Mitzitza Bapeh, and we should not do it. This is, again, a couple other articles. New York and Jewish leaders reached deal on circumcision health risks. That, you know, this became a debate. Mitzitza Bapeh, the New York City Health Department has an entire website or page on their website called Safe Bris. And I got this really just Googling. Mitzitza Bapeh, one of the first results, especially here in New York City, is the New York City Health Department has an entire page together with a beautiful PDF to be hung up in your shul, school, and community center, both in English and Yiddish, of have a safe bris for your community. And they talk about some of the undoubted founded health risks to the matter. So how do the Jewish communities respond to this reawakened, unfortunate debate? How much of a medical concern is it? And we begin with what we'll say is two extreme approaches. That is of Rav Tendler. The other is of the Sefer Briso Shel Avram, who is written by someone named Rav Biton. I don't know who he is, but it's just a category of a class of broader Svarim. Rav Tendler basically said this is actually, you know, doctors are saying this is dangerous. We have to accept, our obligation is to accept the medical sciences. And he says we will not do Mitzitza Bapeh today. Not only that, Rav Tendler, and this, I don't know if this is probably possible to confirm, but said that if a mole does mitzitz on Shabbos, went as so far to say that he would be chayev echatas because he violated the iser of chavala of wounding someone on Shabbos, and you know that was his very strong stated opinion, kedarko, that he would come down very forcefully and very strongly on some opinions, and that was his response. On the other, perhaps let's say other extreme, we have the Sefer Briso Shel Avram, which, as I mentioned, is part of a much broader category of Sfarim and halachic literature that was written as a response to this controversy. And he basically says that we cannot listen to the doctors who try to infuse and embed within the pure hearts of the Jewish people with all of these falsified and fabricated fears that come out of nowhere and have no basis whatsoever. We cannot listen to them. And through them they attempt to be mevatal, this third element of bris milah, the element of mitzitza. And he says we have to make sure that we come out very strongly and make sure that we still do Mitzitza Bapeh. Dr. Daniel Berman, who is the father of a number of Talmidim who are here in Yeshiva, Ru Berman and Aaron Berman, both chaverim of mine, so this is their father, who is a doctor in immunologist, who also worked together pretty closely with the New York State Department of Health, and actually delved into the research, delved into the literature, and did gave them a perspective from someone who actually is an immunologist and is familiar with what the literature has to say on this matter. It is certainly important to just note the fact that we mentioned Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch is actually the first one to write a tshuva about what is at least widespread in most of our community and other communities as well, is to use a tube for mitzitza, to use a glass or plastic tube that avoids contact between the mole's mouth and the mila. And that avoids any possible medical concern, and that's been in use already since even before the times of Rav Hirsch, and in our community that's certainly pretty common. In other communities, they continue to do mitzitza bepeh. And Dr. Daniel Berman went into the literature and wrote a couple of articles on this topic. Just quote from some of them here, and he basically describes the fact that it's a pretty weak medical argument in the cases that have happened. It's a very, very few number of cases that have happened where there actually has been a link between disease and medical areas. I had a very fascinating conversation with Rav Bleich, who is perhaps the halachic medical expert perhaps one of the top, if not the top, of our community today. Fascinating conversation with him. Told me a few things that are probably better said in private than in a public conversation, but we'll have that, you know, happy to have it with people afterwards. But he pointed out that the risk is pretty small, and presented this to New York State Department of Health, and formulated a more, you know, cushioned response from the city department. Rav Neuberger's approach to this in conversation said that it's about, you know, balancing how much of value is there to doing it specifically at the PE, and how much is there to risk. So even though the risks medically might seem pretty small, but we don't, you know, if we do it with a tube, we're basically doing just as much as we would want to from Chazal. So balancing act, you know, we don't necessarily, we have to weigh the science, we have to weigh the medicine, we also have to weigh the halachic elements, just save questions for after. And that's the that's more or less Rav Neuberger's response, which, as I mentioned, is more or less common. We're low on time, so let's just go through this just a little bit quickly, because I want to bring out a point. Medical history versus versus halach history. This is a point made most clearly by Rabbi Dr. Reichman in his introduction to this book that I have here on the table. And he points out, and that's what the slides were mentioning, that while throughout the ages we have been blessed with Torah sages who have been repositories of all extant Torah knowledge, no such analogy exists in science. So he says that, you know, we have, and that's the picture from before of, you know, just a number of gedolim that we have nice pictures of, but, you know, not to exclude anyone. A lot of the rabbanim who can make it onto this list walked in, you know, are in this room or walked in and out of this room during the presentation. And members who are experts on pretty much the entire corpus of halachic literature have blessed the Jewish people throughout the ages. That's not true in science. And in science, it's something that progresses slowly. And the point of the slide before, this one over here, is that Albert Einstein, who was an incredible, contributed very greatly to the world of physics, knew absolutely nothing about pasteurization, Louis Pasteur, and vice versa. The same is true. They didn't know anything about Bruno Galantucci. Is a researcher I had the opportunity to do psychology research together with, and got a little bit of an insider view into how scientific literature actually develops. Science takes things apart to show how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs has an entire book on this, The Great Partnership, where much more from a popular philosophy perspective, not necessarily from a pure halachic perspective, but comes out with this thesis that science is, the goal of science and religion are actually very different, where science is taking things apart and religion is putting things together, I think, through the context of this presentation. So we also took apart halacha to see a little bit more of how the halachic system works, and we also, I think, you know, at least attempted somewhat to put science together into, you know, make a little bit more of meaning of what science actually is. These are a couple of books that have been published on the broader Chazal and science discussion. The two ones on the board came from very different perspectives, but in any case, to conclude, Taras Hashem Tamima, when we look at the Torah in itself is a complete unit. Tamima means shalem, it means that it's full, it's complete, everything is inside of it. The well-known line from the Zohar, "Stakaba b'Araisa b'Ra'ama," that HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked into the Torah and through that created the world. Then, in some way, every single element of scientific research, development, everything that we experience when we look out in the world could really be seen and is already there in the Torah itself if we have the ability to access it. And we dive in and pray for a day where the world is filled with Torah Mada, but not just the Torah Mada that we often talk about, but Kimala Aretz Deya Es Hashem, that the world will be filled with knowledge of a deep knowledge and relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Thank you very much for joining. As I mentioned, please feel free to ask questions afterwards or reach out to me. Information over here on the slide of how to reach out. And everyone is invited now at this time to session number 2, which will begin, I believe, 11:10, they said, just about a little over 5 minutes. And the options over here are on the board. Once again, thank you so much for joining, and thank you for indulging. Thank you. Everyone have a wonderful day.
Thank you.